Hello everyone, Sean Galvin here. I am a self-employed videographer who has worked in the towns of Hingham, Cohasset, Scituate, Hull, and Hanover, Massachusetts for over two decades, and I have also volunteered videography assistance to Harbor Media on a number of occasions, including today. Today, I am introducing Mary H. Regan and Mary Jane Robinson to the Harbor Media community. Mary Jane, a part-time professor of finance at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, will be conducting an interview with Mary about Life Flashes, a memoir, a literary work in diary form that Mary wrote, which was begun in 2007 and ended in 2021. The book was released in February of this year. I will now hand over the interview program to Ms. Robinson.
Thank you, Sean. It was a pleasure to meet you and work with both you and Mary to prepare for this program for Harbor Media viewers. I first met Mary a few months ago as we sing in a church choir together, and when she discovered that I enjoy reading all genres of books, including nonfiction works, she told me that she'd written a book entitled Life Flashes, a memoir, and asked if I would like to read it. After I purchased and read the book, I informed Mary that I felt as though we had lived parallel lives. We had attended many of the same lectures, gone to the same movies, read many of the same books, and had experienced similar life circumstances. Mary, I would describe your book as part personal memoir, part historical chronicle, and partly a story of spiritual journey and awakening. Would you say that this is an accurate description of your memoir?
I would. And
would you like to expand on that?
Yes, I would, MJ. And it, Life Flashes, a memoir, is part memoir, part historical chronicle, and part spiritual journey. And I want to thank you, MJ, Mary Jane Robinson, for conducting this interview today and helping me to prepare for it. I would like to thank, I'd like to thank Sean Galvin, who introduced us, for doing so, and also assisting with the Harbor Media production staff with the videography. And I would also like to thank Michelle Balcony, the executive director of Harbor Media and Harbor Media staff, for granting us a means of connecting and communicating with the Hingham community. Just to return to the description of Life Flashes, a memoir, if I were asked to describe this 357-page book using four words, I would use the words, it's about promise, suffering, and unimaginable love. If I were able to extend that description a little bit, I'd say it's about promise, suffering, and unimaginable love, regularly sprinkled with good humor. Life Flashes, a memoir, entails author interactions with national, local, personal, and animal figures. It's a story about recovery beyond illness, unemployment, and broken relationships. And it's a testament demonstrating that profound love remains amidst and beyond life circumstances.
It was beautiful to read about your journey. In the foreword, you conclude with the sentence, exuding contentment amidst regularly changing life circumstances exemplifies true success. This gave me pause. When the book opens, you're in a rather dark place. By the conclusion of the book, it is clear to the reader that you have found contentment. Can you elaborate on this journey and transition?
Yes. When you're correct that when the book opens in 2007 on New Year Day, I am in a very dark place. Simply stated, I had lost hope and lost faith in God. And ironically, amid experiencing deep darkness and a sense of profound mortality, I discovered that God exists, unmistakably, without question, and for all time. And I realized that the sole desire of God is to love, guide, and protect all that God created. And embracing these truths, I was willing to become, become a cooperative partner in a relationship with God. First of all, in a relationship with the relationship with God that I share. And second of all, and in turn, in relationships that I share with persons, places, and things that I encounter every day. Interestingly, when I was ill, God was on the back burner. Mm-hmm. What relationships with people, places, and things were on the front burner, what people thought of me, how, you know, financially successful I was. And after this experience, that all changed. And God, and just to go back a little bit, when I was involved in what people thought of me all the time, it wasn't ever enough. Mm-hmm. So when after this spiritual encounter with God happened, that it flipped. And the relationship with God became on the front burner. And so I no longer experienced the same anxiety about people pleasing. And it didn't matter to me. What God was saying to me was, it matters who you are inside. Yes. Amidst changing life circumstances. And that's really where you find contentment. And that is something that only God can teach you.
Today. So you would say you opened a line of communication with God. Was this a thunderbolt moment, or was it a longer process?
Well, I think that God communicates with us in many ways. Sometimes I've experienced moments, and I think we all do, where I feel God have thunderbolt kinds of moments where God has said to me, you know, wake up. It's time for you to look at this. Mm-hmm. But I've also, in the encounter that I experienced on New Year Day in 2007, it was much, I just felt surrounded with benevolent love that one cannot experience on earth, and a very gentle and guiding love, and not bullying at all in any way. Mm-hmm. And a love that gave me the choice to decide whether I wanted it, whether I wanted it, the relationship or not.
Yeah, and I think we need to be open to feel that and develop that relationship, a trusting relationship.
Well, I think, God is not a bully. God's not going to force you into a relationship. God will not ever do that. So if somebody's feeling that, that's not from God.
Was that... I guess I would say, you know, we've all had those moments in life where we wake up and say, I want to make some changes in my life and I want to become a better person. Where did you find the motivation and self-discipline to make the changes you thought were necessary?
Well, I think one of the innumerable benefits of rediscovering a relationship with God is immediately recovering passion for living. And whether one is cleaning a cat litter box, pulling weeds in the yard, ballroom dancing, singing in a church choir.
Finding joy in the things we do.
Yes, finding simple joy. It's enough. Simple joy is enough. And I think, and I realized passion is a very powerful and empowering painkiller, far beyond, in 99% of the circumstances, far beyond any drug.
Passion for things that we're doing is a passion for life.
Yes.
Because that is our life.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is as I grew in passion, and I think as one grows in an understanding of passion for living, we also grow in an understanding that tedium or conflict is a natural part of any relationship, which is something that I didn't accept before when I was ill. I thought that's bad, mm-hmm. you know. And that means the relationship should end. And I think, and so now when I experience it, it taught me, God has taught me, you know, that it's natural. So it doesn't frighten me when it happens. Mm-hmm. I accept that it happens. I don't have to like it. I'm not asked to like it. I am asked to accept it and to, I listen to what it's teaching me.
Yeah.
And usually what it involves is pausing the relationship and seeking divine counsel or, if advisable, human counsel, you know, going away from the relationship, interacting with other people, places, and things, and mm-hmm. then coming back to the relationship and re-engaging. And if that doesn't work, then doing the same thing until there is a resolution.
Yeah, I think that's a great lesson. I think most of us are, I know I am, a conflict avoider. And I think what you're saying is that conflict is part of every relationship. Yeah. And rather than to end a relationship because there may be conflict, is to learn to grow from it, listen to what others are saying and have an open mind and keep going forward.
Right, and that's what I found, that accepting conflict is natural, mm-hmm. helped me, just accepting that, it's helped me to move through, because I relaxed. Yeah. When I didn't think it was natural, I'd be fighting it, and I'm thinking, oh, well, it's, you know, then you start blaming yourself, blaming the other person. A lot of times, conflict, I've noticed, you know, a lot of times conflicts happen, someone hasn't hurt you, you haven't hurt them, you just all of a sudden, you're getting along really well. There's been times when I'm getting along really well with somebody, and all of a sudden we're not clicking. So it isn't about blaming, mm-hmm. it's just about the way it is. You know, if you can just accept the way it is, it helps you to move through it relatively easily, and it also teaches you not to define self by any particular person, place, or relationship, or thing.
Yeah.
You know, you just
Somebody
say, okay.
Let's do that.
Well, that's a human, to it. And then when you realize you're doing that, then you say, okay, wait a minute. No, my life's not just about ballroom dance. My life's not just about being in the choir. My life's not just about family or friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
their
important
components.
For you. Right.
Yeah.
And so, it's important not to be overly engaged with any one of these things.
Mm. The structure of your memoir is unique. Most memoirs are solely about the author's life. What inspired you to include well-researched current events in each of the years that subdivide your book, and also to maintain relative objectivity about those events?
Well, I believe people around the world are affected every day by situations and circumstances happening near and far. And I felt that not incorporating some of these events that were affecting me, and I know affecting other people, would not be realistic, mm-hmm. to say we don't, nobody lives in a vacuum, and it wouldn't be responsible journalism. So, and I just found it fascinating to record it and see and process it personally too, and incorporate it into the, mm-hmm. you know, into the memoir.
It really made me, as I read the book, remember where I was during those important events in mm-hmm. history. Some of them, you know, national, international, and
right.
some of them just local. But I thought they were really well placed.
I think that, you know, it helped me to also realize that no person really is internally controlled by situations or circumstances around them. We are all influenced by these situations and circumstances. But choices that we make each and every day influence who we are and who we become. Choices that we make each and every day influence not only the course of personal history, but
yes.
the course of human history.
Mm-hmm.
That's big.
It's profound.
Big. It's exciting to think that you can, you know, make the choices that you make
mm-hmm.
can affect the course of human history.
I think you and I discovered that we were both avid attendees at the Kennedy Library, and we talked a little bit about authors and politicians and actresses and actors who we saw there over the years. Is there anyone in particular you would say was someone who made you think a little bit differently from the way that you did?
I think they all did. I met a number of not, I met a number of prominent personalities when mm-hmm. I, most of them at the JFK Library. And that's one of the benefits of being able to go there is you meet people that who you would not ordinarily meet in, you know, in your in daily journey. Sure. But you realize we're all very similar. I really enjoyed hearing from former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, and she talked about the work that she has done to help the cause of mental illness. And I remembered. You know, the work that President Carter did to aid the cause of deinstitutionalization mm-hmm. in the 1970s to help mentally ill people be able to receive more individual freedoms and being able to live in residential homes, move them away from being in mm-hmm. institutions. I was very touched by the work that she's done, and she's written a book about it too. And then also one of the things that she said was, which intrigued me a lot, she said that the night before Jimmy Carter was elected president, he was mopping the basement floor of their home in Georgia.
Not an ordinary person in terms of his leadership and yeah. intelligence, but yeah. in the way they lived their lives. He was a peanut farmer. They were kind of simple people, but mm-hmm. those kinds of stories that help us to know these well-known figures a little bit better are always yeah. so much fun to
and
hear.
And to realize we're all very, very similar. We're
Absolutely.
Not the same. None of us are the
not
same.
Not quite as accomplished maybe as the person on stage.
Well, I wouldn't say that. We're all, we all have unique talents and gifts. We just live in different size
True.
Houses,
True.
Different size cars.
Yep.
We're all equal.
Absolutely.
In terms of value,
Absolutely.
We just do differing, you know, we're just, yeah. we do differing things.
It's a good point to make, and it's a good yeah. way to think of things, for sure. You also had a unique approach when you wrote your memoir about avoiding the use of possessives. Can you elaborate on why you chose to use this literary tool?
Well, it came to me, to be honest with you, it came to me over time.
Can you give an example for our viewers?
Sure. It came to me over time, and it was important for me to learn I wanted to be detached from the reader, but I didn't want to be distant. And instead of using words such as my car, my brother, my house, I might say, you know, the car I drive, or brother Jared. Sometimes I would use mm-hmm. the possessives. But there were times when I wouldn't because I felt it was important to move the reader away from that.
I liked it. It was a little different, and then as you get used to it, I find that I really like that way of speaking.
Yeah, I think, well, the reason for using it, too, was also that I wanted to assure readers that Life Flashes, a memoir, is not essentially about any particular person, place, or thing. And I found that not focusing on possession Mm-hmm. It enables readers to connect with person, places, and things in an increasingly loving, respectful, realistic, and connected manner. Mm-hmm. And I believe that this is what happens when people read Life Flashes, a memoir.
Yeah, I think it works very nicely.
Thank you.
And will you explain why you decided to write the book in diary form? Books in diary form have become virtually obsolete these days. Mm-hmm.
I'm actually not fully sure why I did decide to write the book in diary form. I think utilizing this form did prompt me to discern what was truly happening within me, heart and soul. And I'm glad that I didn't change it because a number of literary agents with whom I spoke before I decided to work with an independent publisher, the literary agents wanted me to change the book form into a narrative.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so, and now, diaries are not popular now. So,
You didn't let it deter you.
I did, well, it wasn't a sense of defiance. It was like, my heart and soul can't do it. I just can't do it.
I can understand that.
And the last agent that I talked with, I didn't say this out loud to her because I didn't want to be disrespectful, but you know, I thought, well, Anne Frank wrote a diary and her book sold a few copies. And, you know, to this day, her book has sold 30 million copies. So I just felt it was viable, a viable means of communicating. And then I read a book by local author, not local, I'm sorry, world-renowned author, historian and biographer David McCullough.
It was called lives locally.
Right. Yeah. Right. And he wrote this book called The Wright Brothers about Orville and Wilbur Wright, who were world-renowned aviators. And I read it, and at first I thought, I confess I thought it was a little bit dry because they were so involved in their work. And then as I read more and more, and I just let go of who I wanted these characters to be, and I just let them go, and I accepted them for who we are, I loved the book. And I said, this is why he's, you know, David McCullough is such a good writer, is because he challenges you to go outside your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's what a good writer does.
Yeah.
So I was so intrigued with the book. I hadn't intended to write him, but I did. I wrote him a letter, and then I sent him four chapters of Life Flashes of Memoir.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I think maybe October of 2016, I thought, I don't know him. He's not going to write back to me. And I wouldn't be offended. So in December of 2016, a few days before Christmas, he sends me a letter.
Oh, my goodness.
That's
Christmas present.
Yeah, exactly. That was typed on a manual typewriter. He's still writing books. He's an octogenarian. He's still writing books. And he said that he had read the few chapters and that he liked it, of Life Flashes a Memoir. He liked the book and he encouraged me to finish it. And he said, as a historian and a biographer, I really depend upon people's diaries and letters, and they're not writing them anymore.
That's so true.
And so then I was intrigued. I said, oh, I want to find out how long it's been since people have been writing letters and diaries. And it's been over 30 years, like since the late 1980s and 1990s. And I realized that
it's rare to receive a letter from someone today.
Well, and you know, and letter. we've all been tempted. It's the social media is by the immediate gratification,
that.
And as you pointed out, the availability of it, that we people don't do it. But at the same time, we all know that when we write something on social media, it's not truly private. So that has not destroyed, but it has crippled the ability of people to be truly intimate.
Interesting. Yeah, and
which is what letter writing and diary writing.
And diary writing for sure.
Right. I guess the other thing too is that writing in diary form encouraged me to reassure me of the importance of setting literary limits when you're writing, and what I mean by that is. Well, how do you do that? How do you set literary limits? You do this by respecting human dignity, privacy, and mortality. And not doing so damages the relationship between the author with readers, with book characters, and the author self-reputation.
Yeah.
I find.
When you think about it, you have a relationship with everyone who reads your book.
Exactly. And everybody in the book.
Yes.
You know, inside and out. And I remember somebody saying, you know, I don't know who it was. I looked it up. I couldn't find out who it is. Maybe somebody, you know, I'm sure somebody out there knows. Somebody very wise once said, do not ever write anything that you wouldn't want to read on the front page of a newspaper. And I found that to be very
it's good
wise advice. And that's why it's very important for writers to regularly check what they write for accuracy, clarity, and appropriateness. Because you can write something and then you can look at it 3 or 4 weeks later and say, well, that did happen, but I don't think I'd want the world to know about
you
it
need
in that
to include
way.
That.
Right,
oh,
and
yes.
You can still, and it doesn't mean that you can't talk about, you know, difficult things. It's just a matter of how you handle it, you know.
I can understand the sensitivity of that, to be sure.
Yeah. Finally, I would like to say that I think I realized that writing that respects human dignity and privacy and mortality is writing that builds trust.
Wonderful. Mary, talking with you about Life Flashes, a memoir, has been very interesting and thought-provoking. And I hope viewers of this program will be intrigued and will seek the book and read it. It is now available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Thank you very much, Mary.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.